Taylor, Sparkman, Parnell, and Finkelstein. First bill before us is House Bill 153. We, as an oversight, forgot to include that when we passed out the other companion bill last week. Is there anyone here who wants to testify on House Bill 153? We did have testimony last week.
I've moved the bill with individual rec.
It's been so moved. Is there objection? Hearing no objection, it's so moved.
Just a note for the record before you move on to the next agenda item, Mr. Chairman. Due to the fact that we're having a hard time getting a quorum, I'll continue to provide and assist you, and I'm sure Mr. Wacky will too, to accomplish that purpose as long as we see that, and I think we have seen on a few, very considerate attitude towards minority legislation. If in fact that attitude changes, we will not be available for a quorum if we can do a quorum amendment.
Well, thank you, Mr. Taylor. Everyone's help in getting a quorum is appreciated, I can tell you that. Next bill before us is House Bill 12. Representative Moyer, if you could join us.
Appreciate the opportunity. Representative Tom Moyer for the record from District 19. I introduced this House Bill 12, Mr. Chairman, for one reason: to attempt to help to diversify Alaska's economy. We've all talked about that in our campaign. It's my hope that although the bill is complicated, its intent is that simple: to attract foreign investment in Alaska. We are at the tail end of a trend in our corporate tax policies. We are the only state left that gives our corporate citizens no option when it comes to the method available by which we tax. In fact, in 1984, for example, there were 12 states that still had the worldwide unitary tax. Under such a system, as you know, all the income of the corporations combined and taxed regardless of the location of its operations. Today, as I said, we are only the only state with such a system. All the other states, including many of our states that excel in foreign trade, such as California, Florida, Oregon, have all changed their laws. I hope this is not one case where we can continue to feel that we don't care how to do that outside, but rather catch up to the other 49. The bill is not a new idea. The version that you see before you is very close to the one that passed the Senate last year. It includes domestic corporations, which was an objection last year that it did not. It does not apply to oil companies. And the bill doesn't do everything for everybody. Indeed, there would be a loss to the Treasury, as reflected in the fiscal note, of between $1.5 and $3 million. If that is accurate, I believe it's a small down payment on a longer-term return to the Treasury in terms of international trade, be it storage and assembly for international corporations building such facilities in Alaska or small package processing, whatever. Can't prove it. Can't prove that these things will happen, but we do know we've got a better chance of attracting new business if this tax change is made. There is quite a list of supporters of the bill. Some of the representatives from those supporters are here today, the Anchorage Economic Development, State Chamber of Commerce, the Miners Association, and I especially want to note the presence of Mr. David Harlow, who is an international tax consultant from London and a member of the International Chamber of Commerce, who can answer questions along the any. I'll be glad to take a stab at it. I'll just stop at this point, Mr. Chairman. I encourage you to hear from all the experts, some of which are actually lawyers.
Any questions for Representative Moyer? I had one on the treatment for foreign dividends. I'm not sure if there's any explanation you can give on the.
Mr. Chairman, I'm glad to, and we might ask the same question to Mr. Harlow. But it's common practice to include some form of taxation on dividends earned by a domestic corporation on their foreign dividends. It's not applied to their domestic dividends. The percent that is excluded, that's debatable. 80% is a number that wasn't there previously. It's in there now. I'm sure you'd hear some say it should be lower. I doubt you hear some anybody say it should be higher, but that's a debate between those who'd be affected and the Treasury.
Have you ever heard any identification of what the other states do in that matter?
I think it probably
carries.
Harlan would be a better one to answer. It varies, but I do believe 80% is used in some of the other states. We can certainly verify that.
Okay, and there's a real basic question, which is obvious, and you're probably the best to answer, is the logic behind the exclusion of oil and gas from a bill such as this.
Simply because this is a bill designed to invest or attract foreign investment. International trade bill. It's not intended to be a oil company bill or a union matter or a separate county matter. Strictly a attract foreign trade. That's the way the bill's been in the past, and it's the way I drafted it with that intent.
Okay. Any other questions for Representative Wire? Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. One question.
Oh.
How come you come up with less controversial?
I stay up night sleeping, not sleeping, wondering what I can do.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
David Harlow, if you could, just identify yourself just for the record as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for the opportunity. And thank you for the opportunity of being able to testify here. My name is David Harlow. I am the rapporteur, which I think translates as general reporter, of the Taxation Commission of the International Chambers of Commerce. My goodness. The International Chambers of Commerce is the body which is based in Paris, with, which has representatives from 100 countries or more participating in it, that speaks for international business. The Taxation Commission is one of 20 commissions within that body that deal with a number of topics, such as the environment or whatever. The rapporteur, the general reporter, is the guy, one of the three officers of the commission. He has the dubious privilege of earning enormous kudos, no money, and no reimbursement of expenses. So it's an unpaid job, and I also act as a consultant, including for my previous employers, with whom I retired last year, RTZ you call them, and they in fact are picking up the tab on this one, on this trip. I know time is short and is and you want me to be brief, Mr. Chairman. I will talk, if I may, on the view of this particular problem from the foreign investor. The worldwide unitary system is something that the ICC has been against for many years, including, in particular, the representatives from the United Kingdom, Japan, some European countries, and Canada, on grounds of principle, in that this is not a basis of taxation that is normal or conducive to international business, but also in terms of practicality, too. There is a question of cost, and the cost to California of moving away from worldwide unitary is estimated by them as $300 million a year, and I think there is a feeling within industry and the foreign investor that there is a big cost in to them in terms of worldwide unitary. Because what effectively it's doing is going beyond the national boundary and taxing overseas profits. And if every country in the world did that, then there wouldn't be much left of the way of the profits to be made that are all done in tax in a number of jurisdictions. Equally, there's a problem on compliance. RTZ is significantly involved in California. And we looked, as a result, at the consequences of complying. And we came to the conclusion, based on our experience on much less demanding legislation in the United Kingdom, that where we are having considerable difficulty in complying with the United Kingdom's requirements, for the simple reason we've got 1,000 companies around the world, and gathering information for all those, it's a just appalling job, even if you can get hold of it, that we wouldn't be able to comply with the requirements in California if we were on worldwide unitary there. We also have estimated the cost of compliance very highly, and this is a question of millions of dollars to actually comply with the legislation. These factors are considerable deterrents, I think you might say, for any foreign investor going into an area where they're going to incur those sort of costs. Another issue is one of certainty and of stability. the foreign investor doesn't like playing a game where you've got the goalposts on the hockey field being moved and the shape of the goalposts being changed. It is much easier to conduct international business, and one's much more comfortable conducting international business if the goalposts stay in the same place, i.e. the rules aren't changed, and that you can have confidence that in the continuance of the existing regime. So certainty and stability is something that very definitely the foreign investor is looking for. There are occasions when a change is necessary, and we all know that. And I think this is perhaps one of those occasions where some change is desirable. Another issue is, of course, the specific issue of the image of Alaska, which, forgive me for saying so, and I do so, I know at risk to my life, but Alaska doesn't have the best image of the various states in the United States to the foreign investor. This is, worldwide unity is one of the factors, and I wouldn't like to say it's the only one because it isn't, that affects that image. And I think what that means for a foreign investor is that given a choice between investing in Alaska and the same investment in one of the other states, he would be likely to opt for the other state. There are, of course, some investments where you can't choose where you make them. If you're involved in natural resources, you have to invest where the natural resources are. And where the natural resources are, you then say, well, if it's in a jurisdiction that you regard as risky or not entirely desirable, you essentially look for a much greater profit margin in order to cover yourself for the risk than you would if you were investing in a different jurisdiction. And I think the effect of that for the foreign investor is that the investments in Alaska will be fewer because the less profitable ones just won't take place. It's also, I think, true and fair to say that if somebody is already investing in Alaska, they are within the Alaskan regime and the compliance problems, etc., they will be experiencing already. And so worldwide unity is a greater deterrent to the new investor who hasn't got an existing investment in Alaska than it is to the existing investor. Though it is a deterrent there too. What have I not covered? I think that's covered the main things on the foreign investor view. And I can't give you an answer which I'm sure you would like, which would say, in a particular case, an investment will be made if you pass this legislation, or a particular investment will go elsewhere, and all those sort of things that I know you people would like to hear. I can only give you my gut feeling, and my gut feeling says that Alaska will get a lot more foreign investment if it passes this legislation, which I think will convey an important signal to the foreign investor than if it doesn't. And I think the figures that I've heard of 1 million to 3 million as an annual cost may be quite a small price to pay for that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. Any questions from the committee? One question I had, and you sort of addressed it, I realize it's not possible to pin down the new investments drawn in. Do you have experience, though, on some examples you can mention, at least anecdotally, on businesses that previously were, scared off, or where it was a major factor in the decision not to come to Alaska, not to get involved in Alaska, that kind of...
Anecdotal on Alaska?
Yeah.
Yes, I can in fact turn a little bit to Arthur Zed, where our own view of Alaska is coloured by worldwide unity. And the United States Borax had a molybdenum deposit at Quartz Hill, lower down the panhandle. The effect of worldwide unity was a part of the factor that made us decide not to go ahead with that.
Is it representative?
Oh, go ahead.
Are there any others that fit that mold of, besides your own company that you've known of?
I find that very difficult to answer because I'm not authorized by anybody to answer about their affairs. So would you excuse me?
Sure.
But I think those examples do in fact exist. It's always difficult because anecdote tends to distort one factor or another. Usually an investment decision is influenced by a number of different factors, of which the worldwide industry is one. And it's very difficult to sort the facts out. What was the major factor that caused this decision to be made one way or another? It's not a simple answer to that, a question to answer at all. On the other hand, I do think that there are some states that have abandoned worldwide unitary that do feel that they have gained more investment following their abandonment. Why that is, I'm not going to say. I don't know. I think Oregon, for instance, would be one.
Okay. Representative Taylor?
Your former employer, you've said their name a couple of times.
RTZ, or RTZ, as I think I should probably call it, we call it RTZ in England, which was originally the Rio Tinto Zinc Corporation, and is involved in Alaska because, apart from the United States Borax activities, which I've mentioned, we acquired BP Minerals Hard Rock activities a year or two ago, which includes, of course, Kennecott.
Since they were willing to send you over here as an expert, I feel I'm an expert on almost everything and would be willing to go over there at any time.
It could be that they wanted to send me over here to get rid of me.
Don't mention that. I'll find a word.
It's the same here. Yeah.
My popular debate.
Any other questions from committee members? Representative Parnell?
Do you have a feel for what companies are presently doing business in Alaska that this would have an impact on?
You've got to turn on the mic.
I don't want them to hear.
I really think that's a question you should be addressing elsewhere. Clearly, companies that are... Are you meaning foreign?
Presently doing business here.
Foreign controlled or domestically controlled?
Foreign, mostly.
I think a foreign-controlled company would feel much encouraged. They would feel that Alaska is making a move in the right direction. They would feel that Alaska is moving into a more orthodox international mold, and they would feel happier about that than the present situation. Does that answer the question?
Not at all.
I didn't answer.
What companies are doing business here now, presently, that this would have an impact on?
I think there are relatively few European companies that are doing business here. I understand there are a number of Japanese companies that are doing business here.
Are there any members of this International Chamber of Commerce that are doing business here that this will have an impact on?
Well, the International Chambers of Commerce, the members are countries rather than individual corporations.
But their corporations make up their membership.
Yes, I'm dealing essentially with countries and representatives of countries. And I know that, for example, Canada, the United Kingdom, Japan, the Netherlands, Germany, and Spain have all, in particular, expressed desires that Alaska should introduce some form of water's edge legislation.
Okay, and so that would be so that they can come rushing to Alaska and do business here?
Well, it certainly exhibits an interest in doing business in Alaska.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Representative Ken?
Yeah, you indicated, David, that
that from your knowledge of U.S. Borax, that it had been one of the factors that influenced their decision.
Yes.
Regarding the molybdenum property. Oftentimes, we as policymakers do not have the opportunity to review or have presented to us why a particular company or corporation makes a given decision.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that that decision was impacted by policies or legislation passed here, we sit in the dark, basically. And I was wondering if you might be free to make such comment, and I'm not requesting anything of a proprietary nature in this, but merely a summary or summation, if you could, as to what other policies or ramifications may have been considered by U.S. Borax in making their decision, aside from the unitary tax, which you've already expressed. And I know it's not related to this legislation, Mr. Chairman, but I think it would be extremely interesting for all of us to have that information, since it's a world-class molybdenum find that is not moving forward at this point. If we as a state have participated in causing that not to move forward, we need to understand why.
I wasn't personally involved in the decision. I can therefore give you only hearsay comment. The two major factors that also were probably, in fact, in all honesty, greater in their impact than worldwide unitary were, first of all, the worldwide molybdenum market. It is a large deposit which would have taken a large market share, and there were marketing problems attached to it. The other major factor that actually was there was that it having been established with the appropriate authorities that there would be a discharge of certain materials into the ocean in one particular place, there was then a change in the rules of the game, and that the site for the discharge was relocated to a different place. That had a significant effect on the economics. Those two factors undoubtedly were part of the decision.
Thanks, David. I have another question. We have a letter to us, I think it's in our package, from Bogle and Gates, dated February 20th, and in it it talks about your chamber's position on the legislation. It says, with minor revisions to design primarily towards complying with the holding in Barclays, being the Barclays Bank California versus Franchise Tech Board, court case, the International Chamber endorses the enactment of legislation similar to HB 12. Are you aware of what the minor revisions are? What's the status of that?
The minor revisions. I know that I've been discussing them yesterday together with a representative from Bogle and Gates, with Susan Burke, who I understand is here. I don't think there's anything terribly fundamental in those, and I think it's a question of further discussions taking place before they're finalized. Basically, we are, as in the letter indicates, the ICC, that is, in support of HB 12. I should have mentioned the letter that you're mentioning, in the sense that there was an ICC policy statement on water's edge taxation in Alaska, which I know has been circulated to legislators, which I should have referred to earlier. I apologize for my omission.
I guess the question is, what is the impact of that case, and is there... You don't think there's enough significance.
I'm sorry. I think the impact of that particular case in the longer term may be of distinctly significant so far as Alaska is concerned, because that case held that worldwide unitary legislation was unconstitutional under the Foreign Commerce Clause of the U.S. Federal Constitution, I understand. That, of course, is a Court of Appeal decision in California and will undoubtedly be, go further in the appeals process and will probably land up in the U.S. Supreme Court, which could then, if it is upheld, which might be, as I understand the timing, in the fall of 93, leave a position where worldwide unitary, as practiced in Alaska. I'm sorry, am I not? I'm getting quite a battery in these things. that worldwide unitary, as practiced in Alaska, would be unconstitutional. Well, obviously, things would very much become in the melting pot in Alaska. But the situation at the moment is that it's a California decision only.
I appreciate that. The I don't know if it's possible to get, but the what drew my attention to this is the sentence that states the chamber endorses with this with the minor revisions signed towards complying with the holding of Barclays. I'm just interested in at some point finding out what those revisions would be.
There is one particular thing that relates to the holding in Barclays, and that is that. Sorry, may I go back for a moment to the Californian position? Barclays held that worldwide unitary was unconstitutional. That was on the basis of the position in California before they introduced Water's Edge legislation. But the Water's Edge legislation, if Barclays is upheld, must be very much in question. Specifically, how can California charge an election fee for somebody electing to have their constitutional rights? And also, how can you make it conditional that you can have your constitutional rights if you do something like producing a domestic spreadsheet? At which point in time, I wonder whether it is desirable in the bill that's before the House at the present time to make it a condition for there to be a domestic disclosure spreadsheet. That would be the impact of Barclays, potentially, and I would certainly suggest to the committee that that's something that you might wish to consider.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? I had one last one, the same one I asked to the sponsor on the 80-20. The questions on the 80-20 split on dividends is, I guess we heard that there's no magic number there. It's just an attempt to pick a fair treatment. What would be the feeling of companies such as yours on that figure? Would it make much difference?
The International Chamber would not be greatly interested in that particular issue. The reason being that if I'm a UK investor and I'm investing in Australia, what I'm likely to do is invest directly in Australia, which would produce no dividend flow into the United States, and therefore the question of tax on the dividend flow from Australia to the United States wouldn't arise for me. It's the domestic parent who would be investing in Australia from the United States. So in broad principle, it isn't something of concern to the foreign investor into the United States. It clearly, as a matter of international precedent, is appropriate for a state such as Alaska to contemplate how or whether it wishes to tax a dividend of that nature. I would suggest that that's likely to be impacted by the particular aims, the policy aims of the state concerned. For example, if I may turn to the far side of the states and look at Georgia, which is anxious to encourage multinational companies to set up their headquarters there, and particularly in Atlanta, then the legislation effectively means that dividends flow through to Georgia without being subject to tax. But this is that is a call based on the policy of Georgia in trying to establish itself as a base for multinational holding companies, and a state with a different policy can come to a different conclusion. And I think the particular rate is of exclusion is something that really reflects the policy of the state.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it. answer. Appreciate your time today, too, coming. We may have questions later, so your attendance, continued attendance is appreciated at the hearing. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ron Garzini, you signed up. Did you want to testify? I can't tell.
Defer. I think Scott Hawkins is going to be on teleconference.
Okay, great. Susan, could you join us?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Susan Burke. I'm with the law firm of Grossenberg here in Juneau, and I represent the IBM Corporation. I would like to support very much what Mr. Harlow has told you today about investment in Alaska and the impediment, if you will, that Worldwide Unitary creates for increased and enhanced investment by multinational corporations in Alaska. And I won't repeat all of that. I will simply say hear, hear. IBM has been active in the worldwide unitary reform efforts around the country for years and years and years. And when the issue came up 2 or 3 years ago in Alaska, they were alert to the fact that it was an issue that was being discussed and came to be active in the issue here. There is a great amount of support locally in Alaska for this legislation. The Alaska Miners Association, the Fairbanks Industrial Development Corporation, you'll be hearing, I think, from Mr. Hawkins, from the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce, the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce, the Alaska General Contractors Association, individual companies like Xerox, Brown & Root, Fluor Daniel, and so on. I'd like to talk a little bit about, since IBM is a multinational corporation with a domestic parent, some of the issues that the domestic multinationals think are important in this legislation. And as a short bit of history, when the unitary reform was introduced in, I guess it was the beginning of the 1989 session, it provided for the reform for foreign parent multinationals only. And there was a great deal of concern on IBM's part and on the part of other corporations around Alaska and eventually people in the legislature, including the Senate last year, that it was important that domestic multinationals be treated even-handedly vis-a-vis multinationals with foreign parents. And in order to do that, there are a couple of features that are very, very important, and it's going to get a little bit confusing because I'll be talking about 80-20 corporations and 80% exclusions on foreign dividends, but let me talk first about the 80-20 corporation. And that has to do with which corporations you include in the income tax return and in the income attribution that Alaska looks at in order to determine what its fair share of that income is to be taxed here in Alaska. And a company, regardless of where it happens to have its legal site of incorporation, whether it's in the U.S. or in a foreign country, if it does the vast, vast majority of its business in a foreign country, we think that it should be treated as if it were a foreign corporation. In that way, you are treating subsidiaries of U.S.-based multinationals the same as you are treating subsidiaries of foreign-based multinationals who would never be seen as part of this water's edge group simply because of where their subsidiaries are incorporated, which is to say in foreign countries. The second area, and this is something, Mr. Chairman, that you mentioned and I would definitely like to address, is the issue of exclusion of dividends. Mr. Harlan made reference, for instance, to a UK company that does business in the United States but also wants to make an investment in Australia. That company would make the investment in Australia. The dividends would go back to the parent corporation in the UK. The operations of that corporation's subsidiaries within the United States would be taxed in the United States and by Alaska based solely on the business operations within the United States. So those Australian dividends would never become a factor in terms of they would never be subject to taxation or apportionment by Alaska or any other state. If you're dealing with a domestic multinational, in that same example, making an investment say, in Australia, and sending a subsidiary corporation, a U.S. subsidiary corporation, or even setting up a foreign corporation to do that. The money is earned in Australia. All of the business activity takes place in Australia. Taxes are paid on the income that's earned in Australia. And then finally, what's left in the form of a dividend, which is after tax profits, if you will, in the foreign country, are then sent back to the domestic parent in the form of dividends. If you're going to treat the UK corporation and the US domestic corporation even-handedly, it seems to me to be very unfair to take all of those foreign dividend profits that have been earned in a foreign country, subject them to taxation in the case of the domestic multinational, not do so in the case of the foreign. And the only difference, I mean, let's assume these are corporations that are in the same sort of business and going head-to-head competitively. The only difference is the country in which the parent corporation happens to be incorporated. So that is one of the main reasons. It's a way of ensuring that your domestic multinationals are not put at a competitive disadvantage vis-a-vis foreign corporations in similar lines of business. Then the question becomes, well, if it makes so much sense to exclude them, why are you proposing that we include 20%? And the reason is simply this. There are going to be certain expenses incurred by the domestic multinational corporation that benefit, let's use the Australian example again, the Australian subsidiary in the production of the income from the business activities in Australia. It may be, a little portion of the CEO's salary. It may be a certain amount of accounting that's done at the home office, maybe some research and development. There are going to be certain expenses that are incurred by the domestic parent that help the Australian company earn that income in Australia. If you allow the U.S. domestic company to deduct all of those expenses against only the U.S. business activity income, that's not fair either. That's not fair to the taxing state, since a certain amount of that is going to be attributable. You can pick a variety of numbers, as Mr. Chairman, as you mentioned. 20% seems to us to be a fair amount of dividends to include, assuming that is roughly a fair measure of the expenses and so forth of the domestic parent that went to earn those dividends in Australia. And again, why 20? I suppose the best reason, or not the best reason, but one thing to look at is to look at the experiences in other states and what other states have done in grappling with this problem. Only 5 states include more than 20%. And those states are Utah, which includes 50% of the foreign dividends, California, which includes 25 and maybe a little bit more. They apparently have a complex formula to deal with this if I could describe it to you, I would, but I can't, so I will not. North Dakota at 50%. Maine begins to tax for the first time you're taxed in Maine at 100%, and there's a declining amount over a period of 5 years to get you down to 50%, and New Hampshire at 100%. And if you look at the states that are at 50 or 100 and you think about them, they are not the states that bring to mind a whole lot of big development and economic activity. They tend to be very small, rural, if you will, states. Why they have chosen to do that, I don't know. There may be overriding state policies. Maybe they don't want that kind of economic development in their state for whatever reason. As Mr. Harlow mentioned, it's important to think about Alaska's policy as you look at the foreign dividend issue. And it seems to me that that there are two things that you might be thinking about as you grapple with this issue. The first is even-handed treatment. If you begin to get much beyond 20%, in including the foreign dividend, and remember, this is after-tax income that's already been taxed by the foreign jurisdiction, you begin to get more and more into a situation where you are taxing so much of the foreign dividend of the domestic multinational that you are disfavoring the domestic multinational in favor of the foreign multinational. And if even-handed treatment is an important consideration, and I suggest to you that it should be, then I think you want to be looking at a number pretty close to an 80% exclusion on the dividends. The other part of it is people talk about encouraging foreign investment, and I suggest to you that you ought not to care what color the money is of the corporations that you want to attract here. It seems to me that you should be just as anxious to encourage domestic multinationals to invest green U.S. dollars up here as you are companies. Actually, I think pounds and yen all come in different colors, so I can't give you a color for their money. Multicolored money, I suppose, would be the best way to describe it. And again, in a sense, it's another side of the even-handedness issue. But I think when you are thinking about the kinds of companies that you want to attract here, you don't want to slam the door on domestic multinationals. And if you start messing around too much with the dividend exclusion, I fear you're going to do precisely that.
Before we proceed with questions, I made a mistake earlier. I didn't realize the Commissioner of Revenue was here with us. Do you think we could defer questions? He's on.
I would always defer to the Commissioner of Revenue.
That's all right. Go ahead.
Do you have enough time, Commissioner?
I have to deal with my office at 2:30.
Okay. Well, that'd be great. Representative Taylor?
Yeah. I was trying to follow you, and this is a complex thing, but where we're dealing with
Maybe I should draw boxes on my piece of paper.
Yeah,
that might help.
I don't know. It didn't help me a lot over here. I'm the one with the questions. You got to have the answer. When we're dealing with a state whose primary asset is that of natural resources, and through this legislation we have excluded oil, and I think there's probably a reason for excluding oil that's a very valid one. If, in fact, we contemplate other assets of the state, such as mineral leases or royalty shares or timber, and if, as an example, we have a, and I'll just restrict this question to timber, if we have a corporation that harvests timber in this state and does so, which it then sells at cost, so that it realizes no profit in the state of Alaska upon which we could tax. And it sells those timber products into the international market to its subsidiary corporation, located conveniently in a place that also has a very low tax. Then all of the profit out of that effort will be derived in the subsidiary corporation in that other location, and there will be no tax realized.
Mr. Chairman, much of the problem that you have suggested is taken care of in this bill by the provision dealing with tax havens. If your subsidiary is located in a jurisdiction that would qualify as a tax haven, which is to, and as you described it, it struck me as that, which is to say it imposes very little income tax, then that corporation would be pulled in and that income would be pulled into the Water's Edge group and it would be subject to apportionment and taxation in Alaska.
Thank you.
Thank you. To the chair, would you point that out where that is in the bill?
Sure. Representative Bruckman, it is It's on page 2. On page 2, starting on line 12. And 5 is the fifth in a series of corporations that must be included within the Water's Edge combined.
Okay, thank you. thank you, because when you said tax haven, it was like water's edge to me. I haven't seen a dictionary definition of that term. Thank you.
That's pretty tight, maybe. It's been 90%.
If we have people who are opposed to the legislation, I would certainly like to hear from them. If the commissioner is opposed to the legislation, I'd like to hear from him. If not, if there is no opposition at this point to the legislation, then I'll move that it move from committee, rather than, unless you just wish to preserve these matters on the record.
There's at least one speaker who's going to raise some concerns. I think the bottom line concern with the whole bill is the fiscal note, the lost revenue to the state, which we as a committee are the best representatives of that concern. But I think you have a good point, and we may well resolve what issues are among this committee today. I do know there's a lot of concerns, and it's a very tough issue. But I think we'll get through the testimony as quickly as we can. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you, Susan.
Thank you very much.
Commissioner, if you could join us. My apologies again for not calling earlier.
No apology necessary, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Reed Fisher, the Commissioner of Revenue. My main purpose in wanting to appear here today was almost thwarted, it seems, in as much as you received information incorrectly that I was not going to be here. That was never my plan. The fact of the matter is that historically, and that's the reason I wanted to speak at this point, I agree with Representative Taylor, the Department of Revenue has historically been opposed to this. I cannot really ferret out for you the particular overriding answer unless it is this one $3 million loss in general fund revenues. There seemed to be what I will categorize as a rather myopic attitude towards what are the opportunities, and if the cost is $1 to $3 million, what are the opportunities out here as were described by Representative Moyer, and I believe you've heard from others that while they can't quantify it, and I certainly have no more of a crystal ball than they do, I can't quantify it either. My gut, my reaction, my travels around the United States, etc., tell me that this state sits out here all by itself with worldwide unitary tax type of law, and that the water's edge is certainly the proper thing for us to be going to. I will be happy to furnish to you, I'll not read it into the record at this time, some of the documents that I have received recently that show some of the statistics that were being talked about that are prevalent in other states as far as the 80-20 is concerned, 85%, 50%, whatever, and you can compare then what the state of Alaska might wish to do on the taxation of dividends, as opposed to what some of our sister states are doing, or as compared to. I'll get that information to you, Chairman. But I do want to go on the record that the prior position of the Department of Revenue is just that. The Department of Revenue at this point in time is in favor of this legislation.
Thank you. Commissioner Representative Parnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Commissioner, do you have statistics there that show what corporations would be affected by this and how much they pay each year? Is that privileged information?
I would consider it to be so. The numbers that were developed by the Income and Excise Tax Audit Division of necessity had to go back to tax returns of corporations doing business in the state here, and therefore, under the statutes as I interpret them, I am precluded from giving to you a name and an amount at the same time.
Do you have the ability to give us the exact dollar amount over the last 5 years, the average that has been coming in under the current method?
I believe that's what the fiscal note attempts to do, Representative Parnell. It tells you that it is in the $1 to $3 million category. These corporations, just like your or my income, goes up and down in given years, and yes, this is the range that they feel is correct.
Okay. Would you be comfortable with an amendment in this particular bill that would indicate that if the loss exceeds $3 million, that it would revert back to what we're currently doing?
No, I don't believe I would be. I think we either have to have a law, deferring to Mr. Harlow's comments here, that people can depend upon the stability of it, understand it, or we're not well looked upon in the investment boardrooms of foreign or perhaps even some domestic corporations because of the volatility of our tax laws as you look back over the history of the state of Alaska for the last 30-some years.
Do you or the Commissioner of Commerce have a, sort of a laundry list of potential prospects that would like to come to Alaska if this kind of thing can change?
I don't have a laundry list within the Department of Revenue. I certainly would guess that such a list could be developed and probably properly should be developed by the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. I'm sure that that's a wish list. If I wouldn't want to myself put hard credibility on it. But certainly there are corporations, and I think Mr. Harlow did a good job of explaining it, when they're making a decision as to whether to invest in a particular state, these are the things that they consider, and we presently don't stack up.
You see a loss of, say, a maximum of $3 million. I read some material from a year or two ago that had it up as high as $7 million. What's caused that figure to change?
I think what's caused the figure to change, perhaps, is the individual sitting in this seat at the present time. I think that there is a completely different attitude with regard to these matters and economic development.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Zahi.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know it's kind of always assumptions on that of how much we may lose on this side and hopefully expect to gain on this side, not only directly to the state, but directly to the economies out there. And, you know, I think that maybe what we ought to be looking at is some of the states that changed this. I think Oregon is a very good example. And again, I'm going to be a little naive, but I know Oregon just changed theirs within the last 7 years, I believe. And I do know that some of the magazines and materials that I've read, they have almost completely turned around their economy and have brought in major national and international corporations. I think maybe we can kind of take a look at some of those states, including Oregon, that have probably up front lost a few million dollars, but at the end here, I do know, I think there was a major national and an international, which was a car, major international car corporation ownership or something. That was estimated to bring in something like $500 million or something to the Oregon economy, just with that one corporation. So I think maybe there's a track record out there if we look at some of the other states as to the minuscule we might lose on the state level versus probably the, you know, several hundreds of millions of dollars that we can spread through a state's economy on that.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that Representative Zawacki has put his finger right on the pulse of the entire matter. It is not simply the loss to the general fund revenue of the state of Alaska and corporate income taxes, which is what the $1 to $3 million fiscal note estimates. It is what will these corporations bring here in the way of overall payrolls and growth and solid economy for us as we attempt to diversify our economy, and what ancillary businesses will this create, and what will their taxes be that they contribute to the state's coffers as well as the municipal governments. So it is not just simply a tax on tax type of thing. And I happen to have a little knowledge of the state of Oregon on this. As some of you are aware, I was a national firm accounting partner, and I have talked with some of my former associates, partners in the Portland office of Coopers and Lybrand, and I assure you their attitude towards the water's edge taxation is that it was something they should have done a lot of.
The one question I find the toughest is on the inclusion or exclusion of oil companies. And I realize there's a lot of practical sides to it, too, but from the administration's point of view, what's the logic for not for excluding oil companies?
I want to be very careful in trying to give an answer on that. I think an answer needs to be developed for you. I'm not ducking the answer. The fact of the matter is that the oil companies, as I understand it, are satisfied with where they are today in the worldwide accounting thing. We have three different options that are available to them. Either the worldwide, the water's edge,
or back to Chapter 21, special corporate income taxes that we repealed in 1982. And as I understand it again, they are not in favor of the separate accounting that is required under Chapter 21. I cannot address, I have not heard from them what their attitude would be with regard to the water's edge, but my input, and I will check it out, is that they are satisfied where they sit right now.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any other questions? Representative?
Yeah, just curious, what natural resources or industries would be targeted for investment, if you could answer that?
Well, I would suggest, Representative Ivan, that it is probably our entire inventory of natural resources in the state that national and international and foreign companies would be interested in investing in. Again, I believe that the discussion with regard to the molybdenum find down in the Ketchikan area is typical. I believe that the Red Dog Mine is another one that's Canadian. You have shipment of coal by Sunil into Korea, that sort of thing. Timber, of course, is going through the Orient. I don't know whether there's any limit to what it might be.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. I appreciate your
thank you very much.
We'll go next to Don Lowell of Fairbanks, followed by Scott Hawkins in Anchorage, then Dan Dixon in Juneau. If everyone could keep their comments as brief as possible, we'd greatly appreciate it. Don, are you there in Fairbanks?
Yes, I am, and appreciate this opportunity to talk briefly on the bill. I support the present bill in that it opens Alaska to investment from corporations to invest in Alaska. So it wants the bill to treat United States national and multinational corporations equally. But that's only about 50% of the problem of investing in Alaska is 50%. The other 50% is the question, is Alaska receiving their fair share of taxes? This bill excludes the oil and gas production and transportation, and that really needs to be addressed, particularly in view of the projected declining revenues from oil production. The income tax that corporations are paying, particularly the producers of oil and gas, and those involved in transportation of oil and gas are not paying their fair share of taxes. We had appropriate and fair taxation with separate accounting up until 1981, which time the major oil companies convinced the legislature and the governor that separate accounting was illegal and that the state would have to repay hundreds of dollars. At that time, rather than put the dollars in escrow, though the courts decided the issue, separate accounting was abolished. In 1988, when I had the time and the money to pursue these issues, my wife, my daughter, and I had two statewide initiatives approved by the lieutenant governor. One was to repeal ELF, and the other was to reinstate separate accounting. As you know, the ELF bill was amended by the legislature in 1989, and since we had accomplished part of our mission and kind of run out of steam and money, we dropped the effort on separate accounting. But it's important to note that at that time, we had over 10,000 signatures asking for separate accounting to be reinstated in the state. These were signatures by people from all walks of life from throughout the state. But since 1981 and by 1989, the state has lost over $3 billion by not having separate accounting. That's about $500 million a year. Those figures, incidentally, came from the State Department of Revenue. And we think about economic development and investment in Alaska, that $500 million a year could go a long way for projects like Fire Island, Connect Arm Crossing, Pioneer Roads to mineral and coal deposits, and so forth. And I would hope that one or more of our legislators would either amend this bill to also tax the oil production and transportation, or introduce a bill that would reinstate separate accounting. Otherwise, once again, somebody like myself at a great deal of expense and time would have to go out and again petition for an initiative to put on the ballot so that the citizens of Alaska could vote on that issue. But since you folks down there, the legislature has the authority and the power to do the same thing that we citizens do, can do by initiative, we'd urge you that consider a separate counting. And I guess that pretty well sums up my view on this. The bill goes a long way to rectify some of the problems, but separate accounting, I think, would complete the issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Don. Are there any questions from the committee? Okay, appreciate your taking the time to
anybody else in opposition
to join us. These last people, quick. Scott, are you there in Anchorage?
Yes, sure am, Dave.
Representative Taylor requests all the speakers to be as quick as they can at this point, so he can express his support for the bill.
Okay, Dave, I strongly support the bill, and I'll just say real briefly that we were before you last week testifying on the Ship Creek project. There is some linkage here between the two issues. We will be promoting this Ship Creek project. I know that this probably isn't going to impress Representative Taylor greatly, but we will be promoting the Ship Creek project in the Asian marketplace. We expect to pull together a team that will be multinational in nature, developers that will have interest in more than one country, tour operators or tour wholesalers that will have interest in more than one country. And it would be very, very helpful to our efforts on this as well as other projects not to have to explain in the course of the presentation that, yes, by the way, we are the last place on the planet where you have to deal with this worldwide method of apportionment with regard to our corporate income tax. So the reform that is before you to move forward speedily this session in time for... in time to make a positive impact on the Ship Creek Basin marketing effort would be tremendously helpful and greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott. Are there any questions from any committee members for Scott? Representative Taylor?
I just wanted to inform Scott that I certainly strongly support your marketing efforts. Just include within that marketing effort the opportunity for those people to purchase that land. That way you're not going to need the $30 million from the state of Alaska you're looking for. But it's not the first time that I've been up Sheep Creek.
Nor the last. Any other questions from committee members? Thank you, Scott. I appreciate you for joining us. Dan, do you want to join us?
Hard to say that.
Mr. Chairman, in deference to Representative Taylor, I will submit my comments in writing to you, which I have today. My name for the record is Dan Dixon. I am an attorney with Foster Picker and Shuffleman in Seattle. I serve as counsel to Kedon Rim, the Federation of Economic Organizations of Japan. And I won't attempt to compete with the eloquence of Ms. Burke, Ms. Harlow, and others today, other than to point out that it's good to see many of my distinguished colleagues pursuing this issue, which I think we have been in pursuit of for about 3 years now. I would like to only say that in the course and scope of my business as an international attorney and as developing international business, not only in the Pacific Northwest, in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, but also in Alaska, that consistently the unitary tax is a major impediment to breaking Alaska out of the colder and cold northern regions where it seems to reside in perpetuity. And I would urge this committee to pass this bill out as quickly as possible. I would finally note that with regard to the international institutions that we work with on a regular basis, which include Japanese institutions, German institutions, Swedish institutions, and British institutions in particular, Alaska literally has a red mark on its place on the globe as a place that is tough to do business, not only in terms of its geopolitical position, but also in terms of the way that the government has approached this issue of unitary tax. I think you have the opportunity of acting in a forthright manner and in a consistent manner. And with regard to Representative Parnell's notion of an amendment, I would argue that that would really defeat the notion of consistency that we are trying to provide to the international economic community. And thank you for the opportunity to address you today.
Thank you, Dan, Representative Parnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan, my effort on that was just to rely on consistency of testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Simply put, I take the face value what people say across the mic, and I hold them to it. And if for some reason I slip between the cracks on it, I would like to point that out at this level so that later, not that I can say I told you so, but I like the comfort later of saying we brought that up to the committee. They assured us of this, and that assurance is swept away.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Thank you.
Representative Taylor?
Yeah, I would, at this point, move that committee substitute for House Bill number 12, ITT, be moved from committee with individual record.
Thank you, Representative. There's no move. Is there anyone here in attendance or on the teleconference who wants to testify, who hasn't been able to testify? Is there a discussion on the motion before us? The concern I'd like to express, and I think I'm Representative Parnell is expressing the same concern as the long-term effects of this. We have a tough time in these kind of estimates. I mean, administrations come up with different estimates. It's very tough for us as essentially laymen in this field to try to find out what's really out there. I don't particularly know the solution, and I, you know, probably just vote no rec on the bill, but I do think that if there was any way found to address that, to make the bill sunset in 4 years, I don't know the particular solution. I think it would probably give the legislature more comfort on that, but I do think I don't want to hold it up beyond that.
I'd like to respond to that, Mr. Chairman. I think that's always a valid consideration, and I would certainly be supportive of that concept in that if, in fact, we find we have erred, that's why one legislature cannot bind another. That's why deals made with industry, whether it was with the timber industry on the Tongass legislation, which now we've had the rug pulled out from under us twice by the federal government, reneging on 50-year contracts that were made, and people invested their life savings in those 50-year contracts only to lose them. You see, that's the ability that the Congress has to totally change its mind at any time and say, oh, we're not bound by anything. This legislature can do the same thing, and we did. Through the last administration, you killed a multi-billion-dollar project in my district because the one person wrote a letter, and then all of a sudden we have my state seeing to it that the outfall discharge area for the Millennium Mine changes from running it right into the inlet next to the mine. Then they would have had to build 11 miles of tunnel through a mountain to get into another inlet. At that point, U.S. Borax, after spending $150 million in almost 13 years trying to get permits from this state and the federal government, threw up their hands and said, you really don't want miners in Alaska, do you? And they went away. So no, we have every right, capricious as we wish to be, to change this legislation 2 years from now and 2 years after that, just like we did with the ELF. Some of us remember that battle. But I think it's probably fair, and should be there, that people have the right to change their mind. And if, in fact, this proves out not to be valid, I'll be joining you in the process of changing.
Thank you, Representative Taylor. Any other discussion on the motion before us? Is there any opposition to the motion before us? Hearing opposition, the motion carries with individual recommendations. The next bill before us is a sunset measure. Speaking of sunsets, House Bill number 153. No, excuse me, we've already done 153. Next bill is House Bill 160. We have before us the Real Estate Commission sunset legislation. The person on teleconference is Grace Oakley in Anchorage. Grace, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Great. If you could proceed to your testimony, we're ready.
Okay. I am the Executive Secretary for the Real Estate Commission within the Division of Occupational Licensing, and I would like to testify that the Real Estate Commission supports this bill housing is one of the essentials that people have to have, particularly in this environment, and it is right and fair that the citizens who are dealing with that particular purchase, which in many, for the average citizen, is probably the single largest expenditure that they make, many of them, and within a lifetime, it's appropriate that the people who are working in that industry are regulated and controlled. I refer to the report conclusion of the legislative audit, where the recommendation is that the commission be continued because it says it is necessary for the because of the potential for a substantial economic loss resulting from the business practices of unqualified and incompetent or dishonest real estate practitioners. It's pretty hard to regulate honesty or dishonesty, but we do try to make it uncomfortable for those who operate that way. But on a more positive note, with regard to qualifications and competency, within the last year, with the help of the legislature, we have put in place requirements for education, both for issuing initial licenses and for renewing licenses, so that we are trying to make sure that those people who are practicing are doing it with updated knowledge and with a degree of skill and competency to better protect the public. We currently have about 2,600 active licensees and about 500 whose licenses are inactive and could be activated at any time. Those educational requirements apply to all active licensees, and they all equally apply to the inactive licensees at the point at which they do want to reactivate their licenses. I think that the steps that have been taken and the things that are reflected within the audit report as far as the job that the Real Estate Commission is doing bear testimony to the necessity and also the competency of the commission doing its job. I am not sure why the change was made, but the audit report does recommend that the commission be extended for 8 years. The bill recommends extension for 4. I'd just like to point that out. It's at your discretion which version gets carried forward, but I would like to urge passage of the bill for the Real Estate Commission to continue. I'll be happy to respond to questions.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Taylor?
Yeah. If there is no one else out there that wishes to testify on this legislation, or if there's no one who wishes to testify in opposition to this legislation, I was just going to state that I participated over the last 2 years, in fact, in trying to get the real estate board the authority and opportunity to do a little more self-regulation and education. I'm very pleased to hear the response that that's going well, and I think we'll soon see the fruits of those labors. I think there's no question in my opinion that this board serves a very valuable function and should be continued. I believe that it's cost effective relative to the fees paid to the department, and as a consequence, if there is no objection out there on the teleconference, I'd move at this time that House Bill 160 be moved from the committee with individual recs.
It's been so moved by Representative Taylor. Under discussion, we've got some questions. Representative Hunter.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to ask Ms. Oakley a question, if I could.
Oh,
are you still there on the teleconference?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. Has the commission been working on, or have you had any success in identifying the transacting of properties that are held by banks and how that's accomplished?
You mean in their disposal of properties that they have acquired through foreclosure or some other means?
Yes, I do.
We have not been directly involved with that, although there is a provision within our statute that the persons who are working with in a corporation, if their primary purpose within that corporation is an activity that would otherwise require a license, that they also be licensed, and we have taken some steps to assure that that is in fact the case. I wouldn't say that we have made it all the way yet, but we are making some progress in that regard.
Okay. So that would mean that someone working in a real estate department for an institution like that then would be a licensed person? Is that kind of the goal?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Grace. The one question I had was on out of the Ombudsman investigation, the one of the problems they found was related to delays, unnecessary delays with real estate commission activities. Is there anything going on within the commission to try to correct that problem?
There were some very old open cases and investigations that were inherited at the time that the real estate commission was brought back under the Division of Occupational Licensing. And I think that the very old ones have pretty much been cleaned up at this point. The ones that are still bearing very old case numbers and we still find open, there is either some corresponding litigation or something like that is the cause of the delay. I made, just as a reference to that, with regard to open investigations of license complaints, at the time the Real Estate Commission came back under the Division of Occupational Licensing at the beginning of FY88, there were 147 open investigations of varying ages. At the end of FY90, there were 27.
Hey.
And I think that should speak towards the degree of housekeeping that has been done to bring things up to a current status.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any other questions from any committee members? Representative Bruckman?
I don't have a question on a conflict to state I'm a licensed real estate agent in the state of Alaska.
Okay, we'll note that on the record. I don't think she's asking for it.
Right.
Excluded. Any further discussion from the committee?
You don't make any money from
this. The motion before us is to move the bill with individual recommendations. Is there an objection? Here are no objections, so moved. We've concluded our bill today. Appreciate everyone on the teleconference. Meeting adjourned.
They're doing a good job.
Yeah, Craig, we should have extended it.
I don't understand why they didn't, but maybe we can find